This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
Here's some of the texts that have come in from the 425. Sean was great until he got the big money. Then you just started falling down. As soon as he got hit, Marshawn did not fall down. From the 206, compare O-lines. Alexander had one of the best ever. That part is absolutely true. 2005 offensive line that Seattle had was the best in the league. Maybe one of the best that we've seen in the past 20 years. You had two Hall of Famers on the left side in Walter Jones, who I think was the best football player in the league. You never give MVP to a left tackle. I thought he was the MVP that year. He was the best player. He had the best single season I've ever seen a football player have.
Wow.
He was unbelievable.
As an offensive lineman, he jumped out that much?
Yes, just manhandled. He was unbelievable.
All right. I mean, if you're saying an offensive lineman, that's I will believe you on that. It's rare that I notice linemen, and that's an incredible, I think, thing to say about him.
He was better at his position than anybody else was at theirs. Steve Hutchinson was the left guard. Robbie Tobeck, your center. Chris Gray, who had been a veteran and had set the franchise record, I believe, for consecutive starts at right guard. And Sean Locklear stepped in at right tackle. It was a great line. That part is absolutely true. There's somebody saying, hey, where are you hearing people don't like Sean Alexander? I've never heard that. It's 2021, not 2007. He's just not the focus of the team anymore. Look, there are people, and I believe this, Marshawn is a better running back than Sean. I think he was. And I think if you put Marshawn, and just watching him run was more fun, watching and what he accomplished given the lack of quality along his offensive line, especially when he first got here, he was a blast. His personality, I love watching Marshawn play. Marshawn's one of my favorite players I've ever watched. But people criminally underrate what Sean Alexander did here. And that, to me, will always be strange, much in the same way it's strange to me that people will complain about Jermaine Kearse, who was an undrafted free agent, who was one of the best and most productive Husky receivers ever, and somehow people still complain about him. Had three of the most important catches in franchise history, and people still complain about him.
That is strange. Yeah, he's, I think, arguably the most clutch player in franchise history, right? Just given the big moments where he had big catches. And it is interesting the way that he is viewed. This Sean Alexander thing is so fascinating to me. That a guy that won the MVP is someone that wasn't quite as loved. I get it, though, too. There is something to be said for a running back of Marshawn Lynch's style. That's just so easy to get behind, right? Someone who is going to trample people. And with Alexander maybe not being quite that person. And also, the last thing that you saw is Marshawn Lynch. I think it maybe makes those sentiments that you had in 2006, 2007, perhaps a little bit more magnified because you saw something better right afterwards. You broke up and you had a better relationship with the next person that you were seeing.
He is, Marshawn is so incredible. He's fun to root for. It is the uniqueness of his personality, the way he played. But it also, there's something about when you get a reputation as either a player or a coach, it's tough to shake that. And Sean had a reputation. He gets criticized for how many touchdowns he scored. Think about how weird that is. And here's the criticism, which is that he doesn't run as hard and didn't run as hard between the 20s as he did when he was inside.
I saw a couple texts like that, 7-10, 7-10.
That he gets criticized for being kind of the glory hound and wanting touchdowns. Like, that's a weird thing to criticize a football player for. He wanted to score touchdowns too much. Like, he upped his effort. And it's part of that sort of, sometimes guys never resonate. And Sean was a player who, for all of his obvious attributes and the fact that he was the one who would be the last one introduced when they introduced the offense, it wasn't Matt Hasselbeck, it was Sean Alexander, that he never quite vibed with everybody. And some of it was what he said. Some of it was what he said after that making the playoffs in 2004. Some of it was the contract and the uncertainty there. But some of it also was just that he just didn't he didn't vibe with people in the same way that Marshawn did. Like, Marshawn is one of the most captivating individual personalities ever. He's incredibly endearing.
Yeah, his personality is just the cherry on top, and it's a giant, enormous cherry. It's a big box of Rainier cherries. And, you know, back to Alexander, I think the interesting thing about this city, Danny, and just talking about the history of sports fandom here is the way that, and I love this, that this city really buys into the hard-nosed, tough guy a lot more than it buys into perhaps the person who is not quite of that ilk. You talk about Marshawn Lynch. Do you talk about Gary Payton.
Do you think that's different? Do you think that's different than other cities?
Not necessarily, but it's something to take pride in. I feel like that means that you're doing it right. You should be more appreciative of the guys who are hard-nosed, who are tough, who are going to give it their all, the guys who are never going to back down, as opposed to someone who does have a ridiculous story. And I just read the story from 2005 in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer with Claire Farnsworth writing this piece about how Marshawn said he got stabbed in the back, and my God, it's 1 yard. Okay, he would have tied for the title. Like, it's just ridiculous to think about it. And also, there were 4.5 minutes left in the game when Matt Hasselbeck had this sneak. Oh, just a fascinating
he complained
story.
About he complained about a play not getting the ball when they were at the 1 yard line on a play that resulted in a touchdown that won them the game. Like that is what happened, and that did stick in a lot of people's craw. You're right about. So Richard Sherman, Gary Payton, Marshawn Lynch are three of I would consider them three of the most beloved athletes in Seattle sports history. They're all defiant, right?
Yes.
Like, they're all like, you're not going to tell me what to do. I'm not going to be controlled. I'm going to decide my own way. And for a city, Seattle is passive aggressive. Like, I don't care what anybody says. Like, living there for 20, it is a passive aggressive city. And those guys are the exact opposite of passive aggressive. You don't have to wonder where they're standing about anything at all. So I don't know if it's that Seattle loves guys who embody that sort of defiance that they don't actually exhibit. But it is interesting because I would say that not only are those guys beloved, but it's out of step with the rest of the personality in which we're afraid to ask each other or tell each other that we're mad. We just ask, are you upset at something? Is there anything you'd like to get off your chest? Why don't you go ahead and go first in this standoff here at the intersection, and then I'll curse you for going first after you drive on by.
It's the primal thing that we all want to do and wish that we were not in a society that was holding us back, perhaps, right? Because I understand the idea of being passive aggressive. You always want to make a situation as comfortable for yourself and for others as possible. But also the element too, Danny, of just guys who are willing to basically give up the bod for it. And I mean, throw Ken Griffey Jr. into the mix there. I mean, how many times did Ken Griffey Jr. essentially go head first into the wall trying to make catches? And how many times did he get injured because of all of those essentially just all out self-sacrificing dives into the wall?
Yeah. And you combine that with some of the complaints people still had about Ichiro not diving into walls.
Right. I mean, and that's another thing I've noticed, too. Like, is Ichiro even as close to beloved as Ken Griffey Jr.? Definitely does not feel that way.
He's not. And I would say that there are more people who criticize Ichiro's style of play, the emphasis on singles, the reluctance to take walks, the fact that he didn't steal bases. More people who complain about that than complain about the fact that Griffey forced a trade.
Which is crazy.
There's a double standard there. Right. Like, that's definitely another little unique thing. And I always made the point of, like, I loved watching Griffey play. I loved the way he crashed into walls. His body paid the price. And Ichiro, even if you complain about him never doing that, that dude played every day. That dude played every single day. And one of the reasons he was always available is because he was more economical with his body. Because he made sure to stay on the field, and he didn't do things that endangered that. And while that did aggravate some people, you can make the argument that that is much more in the long-range productive interest of the team, is for him to play the way he did and stay out there on the field. You could text in any other sort of weird sports grudges or biases that we have in Seattle. It's kind of a fun conversation. The big news story today, if you missed the start of the show, is that the Mariners suffered two losses yesterday, primarily to their starting pitching. In one, they lost a game to the Twins where Marco Gonzalez got hammered, the second straight start in which Seattle's top pitcher, their number one in the rotation, got touched up. And then they suffered a loss in finding out that James Paxton has been recommended to undergo season-ending surgery, Tommy John surgery, to replace the ligament. There's no bright side to either of those. And the fact that Paxton is gone makes Marco Gonzalez's struggles more concerning. The fact that Paxton is gone makes that more enhanced. You're losing wiggle room, and we're seeing sort of the potential of worst case scenarios for the starting pitching instead of it being better than a lot of people expected.
I don't know how much longer this has to happen before we are starting to just question the idea of Marco Gonzalez as the ace, and I don't want to start doing that now after two starts, because it's early in the season and you hope that he irons things out. And at the same time, too, maybe there is a bit of an adjustment, not only pitching in weather, but pitching in front of fans. But at the same time, these are excuses that you're just making. The pitching's been starting pitching, which we thought could be a strength this year, especially seeing some of the velocity numbers in Peoria, has been let's face it, a disaster. And when you're at the point where Yusei Kikuchi, a guy who has always been inconsistent here, is now someone you're looking at and saying, all right, save us, Yusei. I mean, that's what Saturday is for, because the Mariners have a weird off day today in a three-game set. That's kind of what you're trending towards, and that is very dangerous to be in a spot like that when only the top three guys in your lineup can consistently deliver at the plate.
We haven't seen them start hitting, and we've seen some concerns about the starting pitching. In fact, when Jerry DePoto was on with us yesterday, and this was before we officially knew the news that James Paxton was going to be advised to undergo Tommy John surgery, and before Mark Gonzalez had that start against the Twins, here was what Jerry said about what they'd seen from their starting pitching so far.
And frankly, with our starting pitching in general, you know, with the exception of what I thought was an outstanding start by Yusei and a really solid outing by Chris Flexen, our starting pitching, which we think is pretty good, needs to be better than it was these first six games. And Justin needs to command the strike zone better if he's going to evolve into a steady starting pitcher in this league. That's for sure.
Eight walks. Still hard to move past.
You can't have that happen again. If he has that happen again, I think you probably will see some changes. I'm not sure if they're going to let him work through control struggles that are that deep, because you simply can't do that. I've always thought with Marco Gonzalez is he is the exact type of mentality that you want to have in your rotation. You want to have him be a leader among your group of pitchers. And his results over the past two seasons have spoken clearly about how effective he is. The long-range trajectory for this franchise, you want him to be part of your starting rotation and think he'll be part of your starting rotation when it gets good. But he is not going to be one of your top two starters. He's not like that's not his profile. Yusei Kikuchi could be that. How hard he throws and the stuff we sort of saw. I believe that Marco will correct and get out of this, but it is concerning. He's someone that needs to hit his spots, and if the first start was about him not getting that call at the upper part of the strike zone and he needed to get that, well, there wasn't a similar explanation for what happened yesterday. He just got touched up a good bit.
So you have those problems in your rotation right now, and you know, the one that we haven't really highlighted, I hope Justice Sheffield's able to bounce back, because he had a really great finish to last year. And if he's not able to bounce back, then I think you start looking at your starting rotation and you have to start wondering, well, what do I even have here? And you don't make drastic changes because of that in a year like this where you're not expected to do anything. But every single day, it feels like we're expecting them to do less and less.
It's Danny and Gallant. It's time for us to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallant.
Today's an exceptional day.
What's going on, Maura Dooley?
Not much. Happy Friday, guys.
Happy Friday.
To you, too.
Thank you. Let's see here. First up, a little bit of Seahawks news. I think good news. According to SI Cowboys writer Mike Fisher, the Dallas Cowboys have told KJ Wright's agent that they are not interested in the services of the 10-year NFL veteran at this time.
So he's coming back, isn't he?
What's going on there? I think so, but it's weird that it hasn't happened yet. I mean, we're a couple weeks in now.
No one's offering him multi-years is my guess.
Correct.
And that's unfortunate for him. I mean, the way that he played this past season, I think, does warrant a multi-year contract somewhere. But the problem is that this is a strange season with the salary cap, and I think teams are unwilling to do it. And even if they are, I imagine there would be those voidable years and maybe an idea that it's not a real multi-year extension that he would be getting from some of these teams.
Here's my concern for his return to the Seahawks, that he's seen the offer from Seattle and decided that he's not going to sign that. That it doesn't matter if he gets a better offer elsewhere, that he knows what he is to Seattle and he's not signing what they've offered him to come back, especially because it means he's playing strong side linebacker.
On principle.
That's my worry. I hope it's not the case. I agree with everything you said about the dynamics of the market. Look, it's the second time in 3 years he's been out on the free agent market and hasn't gotten much in the way of interest. Now, last time there was still a 2-year offer from the Seahawks at good money for him. I'm not sure if he's being offered. I would guess he's probably not being offered a pay raise. This might be tough for him.
It's such a strange position to play. It's a critical one to be a linebacker, an outside linebacker that's not a pass rusher. Consistently overlooked position, and I understandably so, but an important position from time to time, as you saw from the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who with Lavonte David.
Juju Smith-Schuster joined Michael Irvin on his podcast and was asked if he's been in contact with Antonio Brown. If you remember when Antonio Brown exited Pittsburgh, he got on Twitter and called Juju Smith-Schuster a bum, referred to him as boo-boo instead of Juju, and Smith-Schuster was just kind of like, I thought we were friends. What's going on here? This was his response to whether they are in touch at all now.
Honestly, bro, if I could reach out, I would, but I can't. You know, he's blocked me on all social media. Between like Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, like my phone number, and you know, we just live our life. You know, I mean, I wish nothing for the best for him. You know, honestly, like for him to go out there and win a Super Bowl, like, you know, congrats to him. And you know, he keep doing. I honestly think he's probably one of the best receivers to ever do it. If we didn't have the fall off, I think our team would be, you know, ridiculous, amazing. You know, with him, Le'Veon. All those guys, you know, who are here. So, but no, there's no relationship. I haven't talked to him since then, and that's just how it is.
Credit him for taking the high road there. I mean, it's probably not easy to take the high road with Antonio Brown, but there also is an element of Antonio Brown being a bit right about Juju Smith-Schuster not being a number one wide receiver. You know, going back to the last point that he made, Danny, I constantly talk about the 2006 San Diego Chargers as one of the biggest disappointments in the NFL over the last 20 years, because that team should have won that Super Bowl. That was a really talented team, and I feel bad for Marty Schottenheimer that they weren't able to win that game because Marlon McCree fumbles that interception of Tom Brady. But that the Ben Roethlisberger, Le'Veon Bell, Antonio Brown triplets never won anything is also a huge miss. And it's one of the reasons why, while I think Mike Tomlin is funny, I have always found Mike Tomlin to be a tad overrated as a head coach.
See, I look at it the opposite way, which is that Mike Tomlin has kept those guys productive and winning games and gotten them to the brink of that with those explosive of personalities, and how hard it's been to keep all of those guys on the same page. But you're right, that talent that they had there, and Ben Roethlisberger is going to make the Hall of Fame as a quarterback, right? Like, it's going to happen, and they will have won as many Super Bowls when he was terrible as when he was good.
The way you just described Mike Tomlin is a way that you could describe Pete Carroll. Right? Managing personalities?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. There are some similarities with regard to that. Yes.
All right. Paul had NFL Network draft analyst Lance Zierlein on his show yesterday and asked which of the quarterbacks available to the 49ers at pick 3 would be the biggest nightmare for the NFC West. This is what he said.
He is, to me, has the traits to become the second best quarterback in the draft behind Trevor Lawrence. And when you say something like that, and we're talking about a guy who has very good athleticism, quick feet in a very big package. He's like 6'4", 227, 28 pounds. I know there's a thought that he's going to grow into a body type of about 230. I mean, we're talking about a big, mobile quarterback with good arm talent who is just scratching the surface and has outstanding football IQ, but just a lack of experience.
My bad. He was talking about Trey Lance there. I didn't realize he didn't mention it at the beginning.
Who do you think the Niners are going to choose?
You know, I saw some numbers on Mac Jones yesterday, and I don't know if this is an attempt at a spin job or anything like that, and I think you also have to raise an eyebrow at a lot of the numbers that have been thrown out since they're not all consistent with what you get in Indianapolis, but Mac Jones did run a 4.7 40 at the combine. I mean, maybe he is a little more athletic than we give him credit for. That's not bad.
I'm not gonna say Mac Jones is a liar, but I'm gonna say whoever gave him that time lied. I've seen Mac Jones run. Mac Jones isn't faster than Russell Wilson.
I want to run against Mac Jones because I would feel confident based off of his body type that I would beat him in a race. That is entirely me belly shaming.
That's very funny. Paul's fast. Paul's fast, everybody. Just ask him.
Thank you. Oh, just ask him. You're the worst. I am fast, darn it. I just haven't been able to prove it in a really long
time.
That's
what I mean. Just ask him.
Yeah,
we can get a stopwatch out here one day.
Wow. Maura joining in. You know what? I was going to offer to sell one of my ligaments to James Paxton. I was going to do it. But you know what? Off the table now. Off the table.
Oh, your feelings got hurt? You got hit right
in the movie. Yeah. I just strained my feelings.
Well, the local media got to meet new Seahawk Kerry Hyder yesterday, and he is just as happy to be here as we are to have him.
I mean, I feel like I embraced that journey. It was a lot of ups and downs, but I've prepared for every moment, especially this one. I'm so excited to be a part of a group I can add to. I can add leadership. I can add play on the field. I just, you know, feeling wanted and someone bringing you in, that's what I've been yearning for, respecting the league. And being able to accomplish that is big, but, you know, I just got to continue to stack days with my teammates and get better at it. I got a lot of football left in me, that's for sure.
I think there's a chance he's better than Jaron Reed.
I would agree from a pass rush perspective. I absolutely think so. I absolutely think that there's a chance of that.
And I also think that there's an element of, hey, this guy has been fighting to stay in the NFL for a long period of time. And I think there's a little more to work with Kerry Hyder than there was with Jaron Reed. And this isn't me trying to, you know, rationalize the Seahawks move, but I just never was impressed by Jaron Reed when he was here.
I get that part. Are we letting the Seahawks off the hook, though? Because they wanted to pay him $8 million for this season. They wanted to pay him $8 million more to play nose tackle this year. And when he said, no, I don't want to restructure it, then they fired him. They were cool with paying him $8 million. They were like, that's an okay use of money. And then when he's kind of dug in his heels and said, I'm not going to restructure it the way you wanted to, they're like, okay, fine, we're done. We're done messing with this. But they obviously thought he was worth keeping the money. Did they lose more in their minds? I'm not saying
that's
from our perspective.
Question. I don't know. You know,
if they were willing to pay him the $8 million and then they just cut him, like, that's not a great sign for how their plan's coming together.
That's a good point. But at the same time, maybe there's an element of them. Well, maybe there's an element of them that were like, you know what, we know that this is the last year. So they decided to talk about it from this perspective. They might, I mean, they have to look back at that contract and say, yeah, whoops. Which happens.
Well, it does happen. They paid him $14 million for one season.
I still don't get it. You know, that to me is the bigger mistake than whatever took place right now.
That is going around the NFL. We've got some hijinks in baseball. Sticky baseballs and one jutted out elbow. Cheating galore. Next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
All right, Paul, you got to choose. Which one are we going to talk about first? Sticky baseballs or a jutting elbow? Which do you want first?
All elbow talk is depressing today. RIP Maple Grove. It was a fun inning and a whatever. So, yeah, let's talk about sticky baseballs, Danny.
All right. There is provision this year. I don't know if you want to call it a rule change or an emphasis change, in which Major League Baseball has empowered umpires to look more at baseballs for potential foreign substances. This comes with the increased advent of technology, in which you can now measure the spin rate on pitches. And spin rate is something that will influence and determine how much a pitch breaks. Now, if someone who, say, has had a lower spin rate in previous years and all of a sudden doubles or maybe even triples their spin rate, it stands to reason that that might not be due to entirely a change in technique, but might be doing something sticky they're putting on their fingers. So baseball wants to regulate this a little bit more. This has been something that's been talked about among players, inferred. I remember Trevor Bauer specifically bringing it up with regard to the Houston Astros pitchers about 5 years ago, saying, hey, look, when a pitcher all of a sudden changes teams and goes from, I don't know, the Pittsburgh Pirates like Charlie Morton, and then comes to Houston and his spin rate elevates, it makes you wonder if only there was something you could add to your hand that would allow your spin rate to spike. He was basically saying they're doing something. They're adding something to their hands or using something on their hands to increase the rate at which they spin the baseball.
You know, I've seen photos that would indicate that that's probably the case, but I also think that just about every pitcher in baseball does this. And this is what gets so interesting when it comes to cheating conversations in baseball, Danny. Even going to the sign stealing or with this, with pitchers doctoring balls. I don't know how you regulate the latter. I really don't. I mean, I've heard stories about how catchers will have spots on their jerseys where, whether it's Vaseline or whatever someone might want to put on a baseball, that a pitcher can tap him on the shoulder or something like that. It's in the gloves. Are you going to make every single time a pitcher comes into the game like a TSA checkpoint, where you're checking to see whether or not that guy has all of those things on him? I mean, it would make the game worse. I suppose it would make the game cleaner. It's such a part of baseball. I actually don't really have a problem with it, Danny. Maybe when it's just super egregious, like with Michael Pineda a couple of years ago, where his hand was
pine tar slathered slathered across his neck, right?
Right. And also on his hand, like it looked like he had dipped his hand in like a jar of peanut butter or something like that. But I don't really have a problem with it. It is interesting to see, though, that Trevor Bauer, who has been one of those guys standing and pointing, is one of the first to get looked at for potentially violating this.
And Bauer had made the point in the offseason, if they're not going to test it, maybe I'll start using it. Like, he's been goading and daring Major League Baseball and poking them about this, implying he might do something. There's been talk about his spin rates in spring training. Like, he's clearly been pushing the envelope. He's trying to troll Major League Baseball. Here's a headline from yesterday from Ken Rosenthal, who writes for The Athletic and is one of the sport's, like, five or six national insiders. Multiple suspicious baseballs from Dodgers' Trevor Bauer sent to MLB for inspection. Latest attempted crackdown by league being put to test. Story. Bauer's made the point of, oh, wow, something that's supposed to be confidential is being leaked to a national reporter. Like, I'm sure this is on the up and up. Buster Olney, who is similar to Rosenthal, is also an insider type person there, had what I thought was actually a fairly phrased response, which is that one pitcher is drawing scrutiny over the foreign substance rules. In this case, Trevor Bauer, seemingly through leaks and innuendo, is kind of gross. MLB should either step up and grab the steering wheel and publicly insist that umpires enforce the rule or stand down. I think Buster Olney is correct here. Baseball is trying to harass and maybe humiliate a guy who's been a thorn in their side on this issue. It looks petty. League offices should be above petty rivalries. They shouldn't go out to try and silence or investigate people who have been critical of them.
That's fair, but what if he's doing it? I mean, would you be surprised if Trevor Bauer was doing something like this? To be perfectly honest, I wouldn't, and I don't even hold that against him.
I wouldn't be surprised. I also think that if you're going to enforce this rule against the one guy who's been complaining about it, you better enforce it against everybody else. If you're going to single out the guy who's been complaining about it and bang him with this rule, like, you better be equally ardent about the other people in the game who have just kept their mouth shut and gone about adding things to their hands to grip the baseball better. There's no room for pettiness. I feel this strongly about the way the league prosecuted the New England Patriots and Deflategate. Deflategate was an absolute miscarriage of any sort of occupational justice. I don't care that Tom Brady got suspended. I kind of like the fact that but anybody who cares about workplace fairness, that was awful. Like that was an abomination. Leagues should not behave like that. League offices should not have petty grievances and scores that they seek to settle.
This is a league, though, that you just can't trust to get anything right. They are sometimes unfairly a punching bag, but go back to the Astros and the sign stealing. I mean, the guys that might have been doing it, do we know definitively that that Jeff Luno was as involved as he was, more involved than perhaps some of the players? Honestly, I believe he was. Do we know that A.J. Hinch, the manager, should have been suspended for an entire season when players who are actually doing it weren't suspended at all, weren't fined, weren't punished at all in any way, shape, or form? That, to me, is where it just feels as if baseball does not even have a stick to wield against its players.
Well, I don't even know if it's a stick that wield. They get caught up in this, we don't want to punish our assets. We don't want to shame our assets. We don't want to. The people that got punished in the Astros sign stealing scandal were the people who are not marketable in any way, shape, or form. But if they're going to take that approach, shouldn't they leave Trevor Bauer alone? Bauer's marketable. Bauer's popular. Bauer's really good. He won the Cy Young last year. But they're like, no, he's making us directly look bad. So we're gonna single out, and we're not only going to investigate him, but we're going to tell national reporters we're investigating him. It's lame. It's so cheesy.
And this idiot league, they're looking at Trevor Bauer, who is polarizing and controversial, and I bet they view him, even though he is technically good for baseball, because every sport needs a villain. I think they look at him and they're like, well, we don't want this kind of popular player.
Yeah, because he's making him look bad, because he's making fun of him publicly. I'm all for it making it. When you said this league of idiots, I thought of John Malkovich's character in Burn After Reading, a Coen Brothers film, in which he says, a league of morons. He's a group of morons that you're in league with. A league of morons. It's Danny and Gallant. We're going to raise flags. That will include the jutting elbow next.
From the pocket, and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
It is that time where we raise, throw, otherwise challenge flags. Pretty much anything is fair game here. I think I'm going to start because we didn't get to this in the last segment. Mora had tracked this down initially and was going to be her flag. I will raise it in her stead because I think she's got something else she needs to point out. But Michael Conforto, whom we love, product of this very Puget Sound region, participant in the Little League World Series, not his finest moment yesterday when he drove in the game-winning run by being hit by a pitch.
Stuck his elbow out.
Yeah, he leaned into that with something else. I think we got the sound of that play right here.
They're saying the play stands. Game's over. The Mets win it.
Wow.
That's Michael Conforto clearly stuck his elbow into it. And Mattingly's coming out and arguing, but I'm sure he's going to be told that that's not reviewable.
But you're trying to get it right. They don't get it right. So why even have replay?
So Michael Conforto gets a game-winning RBI by sticking his elbow into the pitch from Anthony Bass. So the Mets rally for two in the bottom of the ninth, and only now can they fully celebrate as the umpires say that the game is over. What a bizarre way to end the game.
They feel dirty on that broadcast.
That's the Mets broadcast.
Yeah.
That's the winning team's broadcast. They were... I don't think Michael Conforto intended to do that, but he certainly didn't get out of the way. You shouldn't win a game by putting your arm into the path of the oncoming pitch.
He had a big elbow pad on as well.
He certainly did.
Which adds even more space occupation.
We generally don't scrutinize any. Don Baylor, I believe, has the record for hit by pitches in his career. He would just turn his back. Like, he wouldn't get out of the way at all. He'd just take it off his back.
Derek Jeter kind of did that, too.
Did he? I kind of admire Jeter for his toughness. He'd be willing to take those. Although Jeter did dive into the stands at one time and break his face.
That was one of the coolest things that I have ever seen.
It was unbelievable.
And I remembered seeing that live, and I was just like, oh my God, is he okay? It was against the Red Sox, if I'm not mistaken, too.
It was. It was not only against the Red Sox. It was at a time where Nomar Garciaparra wasn't playing because he hurt his whoopee. He was upset or weird or like, you remember that? You remember those days, the end of the Nomar era?
That was 2004, if I'm not mistaken, when that took place. And I think I was watching this at my stepdad's New Jersey property, thinking that there's no way that this is going to be a good year for the Red Sox. Interesting year.
Maura, your turn.
My flag is on you, Paul. What do you mean you don't understand a grilled cheese? There's nothing to understand. It's just delicious.
Well, first off, I don't like cheese. But second off, I just feel like it's so boring. I mean, it's just cheese and bread. Oh, wow, it's grilled. Oh, this is so fantastic. And to put the cherry on top of
the guy who eats cereal dry.
Yeah.
That's boring.
You guys,
my favorite.
You guys
my favorite
voluntarily
thing is watching Paul.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Daddy.
Watching Paul get roasted for his terrible food taste.
Yeah, whatever. You guys are savages. Let's have cold, soggy cereal. Yeah. Woohoo! Sit out in the rain if you want that. Also, I just find it Firefest-esque that the sandwich of choice at the Masters is, look at our fine cheese sandwich, or look at our fine egg salad sandwich.
Oh, you can get chipped beef on toast. That's not the only things available there. But if you're looking to follow golfers around the day, like, you want a sandwich. And those are two, like, easily transportable, devourable. Pimento cheese is really good. Mm-hmm. And the soft white bread with a spreadable cheese that's got the roasted red pepper flavor. Yeah. Pimento cheese sandwich is a solid, solid choice.
We actually had a texter call Paul out earlier, too. They said, you can't be French and not like fromage.
French Canadian.
Ah, that's a fantastic. What do the once they got to Canada, they stopped liking cheese?
I did. I just don't like
Paul. What
cheese.
Do you got today?
All right. First off, I do want to raise a flag really quickly to DMX, who passed away today at the age of 50. That is a bummer.
What you really want?
Ride or die. Yeah, I feel like everyone of my age, and Danny, even your age, has experienced DMX. Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound this passive aggressive calling you old there as it sounded when I came out of my mouth. I'm just saying, everyone has experienced a fun DMX moment, and Danny's face right now is that was not my intent. But you are older than me. I'm just saying, you like rap and you're older than me.
Even your age. Listen, I was listening to Big Daddy Kane when you were just a twinkle in your father's eye.
it is sad news, though. What a fun rapper he was. And we are definitely going to miss him. But I also want to raise a flag to Najee Harris, Alabama running back. This guy might be one of the most fun personalities to enter the NFL in a really long time. I imagine he will be taken relatively early. Here he is on Adam Schefter's podcast being told about Todd McShay's scouting report on him.
What do we think of Todd McShay's report, Najee?
I think that he can kiss my ass. What I'm saying with this is that, listen, like, how is he going to say he showed better production? Okay, look, let's take it. Am I passing me? All right, and then I'm going to go break it down. Okay, so like I said, I did not play freshman and sophomore year, rarely, ever. So I didn't have the opportunity to show I can catch. It's not because I can't. It's because I wasn't in the game to show people I can catch. So let's just stop looking at a stat sheet there and watch the game, you know? Let's watch the game and not a stat sheet. That's what I was saying with you guys. Now, junior year, I have more opportunities. I let the country receive in touchdowns. Why is that? As a running back, I did. Why is that? Well, maybe because I got more opportunities to catch the ball.
Nice.
You don't need to pass the ball to a running back if you have Judy, first rounder. Ruggs, first rounder. Schmitty, first rounder. Waddle, first rounder. Like, what do you need to pass the ball to running? There's no point to, unless you need to.
He bodied McShay, who said that his hands have improved. The scouting report was actually somewhat of a compliment, but he laid it out perfectly there. He didn't have chances to catch the football in college until this past season, and he looked pretty good doing it this past year. He's fun. He also had a conversation with James Palmer where he said, "My name's Najee. It's Najee. It's not Najee. Najee." I like him. I hope he has a successful NFL career. He's a funny dude.
Najee is from a part of the Bay Area that has produced some incredible running backs. Going back to Ken Simonson, it's that East Bay, a little bit east of where De La Salle is. Najee Harris is one of the best to come out of that underrated part of this country when it comes to that sort of talent. And I love the fact that he clapped back. That's
fantastic.
Great. Kiss his butt. Kiss his butt.
My hind parts.
Yeah. Well, it's been a really fun show. Other than being called old, at least for my age. Even someone your age, I believe, was the exact word. Yeah. Even someone your age.
Even someone your age.
Can appreciate DMA. I believe that's what was said. That's fair. Paul doesn't like grilled cheese, so you got to take everything into account.
This wasn't
like,
a good segment for me.
All of his opinions have to be taken with not a grain of salt, but a crumb of a grilled cheese sandwich. Want to thank the Professor John Clayton for joining us, Michael Bumpus for being in the 8 o'clock hour. Seriously, Maura Dooley keeping everything on the straight and narrow, and Paul Gallant with his age discrimination is what enlivens the show. Cheese opposition and his discrimination of his elders.
And he's Danny O'Neill, and he's definitely more likable than me after this segment. Oh, boy. This is like Sabuku in this segment. All right, Danny. Well, you have yourself a wonderful weekend. Coming up next is just
I'm going to go to bed right after I get my early bird special. I'm going to go down and turn in early tonight. It's been a long week for this old folks.
Blue hair Danny here. Up next, we're going to introduce the Sunshine Scale, 1 to 10. What's your optimism level for the Mariners right now after a rough day at the office? So long, farewell. You'll hear Danny and I Monday morning at 7.